Hi, and welcome to the JRB Podcast. I'm Abe Sosher, your host and the editor of the Jewish Review of Books. It's Yom HaTzmaut, Israel's Independence Day today. Of course, Israel has been on our mind every day for the last 6 months. We've covered the October 7th attack, the ongoing Gaza war, and the reactions to it on American campuses and elsewhere. We've done so deeply and from a variety of angles, and we'll continue doing that. But today is, after all, Israel's 76th birthday, and there's more to talk about than the matzav. So I called my friend Shai Secunda. Shai is one of our contributing editors and holds the Neusner Chair in Talmud at Bard College. He is also an Israeli who was away from his family finishing the semester here in America. So he missed a particularly wrenching Yom HaZikaron, which is Israel's Memorial Day, as well as Yom HaTzmaut. We talked about two terrific and timely pieces in the new spring JRB. The first is Yehuda Reinhardt's and Mati Galani's account of Chaim Weizmann's experiences of the very first day of Israel's independence, which he spent not in Tel Aviv with Ben-Gurion and the other founders, but in New York, unsure of his role in the new state he had done so much to establish. The essay is adapted from Reinhardt's and Golani's new definitive one-volume biography of Weizmann published by Brandeis University Press, and it's a delicate, bittersweet character portrait of Israel's first president at a turning point in Jewish history. The other essay we talked about is by Secunda himself. It's a review not so much of a book, but of a library, Israel's newly rebuilt National Library, whose opening was delayed by the October 7th attacks. The new library, Shai writes, is, without exaggeration, the most exquisite building erected in the history of the Jewish state. As he also makes clear, Zionism was always not only about the ingathering of the exiles, but also about the ingathering of books, manuscripts, and other cultural treasures. This goes back to the cultural Zionism of Ahad HaAm and Bialik, not to speak of a certain book collector named Hasanovich. But let's let Shai Secunda tell us about that. Shai, great to see you.
Good to see you too, Abe.
Before we get to your terrific essay on the new Jewish National Library, I want to talk a little bit about Yehuda Reinhardt's and Mati Galani's essay, or rather excerpt from their new, big, massive, important, one-volume Chaim Weizmann biography, which picks up on the day which will become Yom HaTzmaut, the 5th of Iyar, Friday, May 14th, 1948, and tells us what Chaim Weizmann, arguably along with Ben-Gurion, the man most responsible politically, diplomatically for the foundation of the State of Israel, what he's doing. Ben-Gurion is in Tel Aviv, and Weizmann is in New York. And one of the fun things about this essay, which I encourage everybody to read, is that it's this granular account, almost moment by moment, of what Weizmann is feeling and thinking and doing on these days. But it reads like a short story. And I thought one way we could begin our brief discussion of that is I'll just read the first paragraph. So here it is. On the 5th of Iyar, 5708, Friday, May 14th, 1948, 4 in the afternoon in Tel Aviv, 9 in the morning in New York, the Provisional State Council convened in the Tel Aviv Museum to declare that an independent Jewish state would come into existence and that the council would then reconstitute itself as the Provisional Government of Israel. Chaim Weizmann, 74 years old, ill and both physically and mentally exhausted, received the news in his room at the Waldorf Astoria, which was kept dark because he could not bear the light. He sprawled on his bed, his face to the wall, as if he had just finished a marathon. His wife Vera entered. "The Jewish state was proclaimed in Palestine," she told him. "The name is Israel. I would have preferred Judea." Silence. Weizmann turned his face to his wife, who stood gazing into his eyes, waiting to hear what he would say. That's how the piece begins. So the first thing is just that he's not in Israel. You know, Ben-Gurion is, And he also, he doesn't know what his role in this new state is. He knows the magnitude of what he has achieved diplomatically going back 30 years, more than 30 years. 30 years takes us to the Balfour Declaration, in which he was instrumental, but really he's been working on it for his whole life. And now he's an old man.
It's a remarkable moment. I think part of why it's so striking is that the declaration itself on site in Tel Aviv is so well known, especially in Israel. We know the recordings and how they sound of Ben-Gurion declaring the state. We know the scene set at the museum. We know where everyone's standing. It's become part and parcel of this day, is that moment of declaration from this new Hebrew city in this new Jewish state. And the fact that this excerpt takes us off-site speaks to this moment in time, that not everything is happening in Tel Aviv. And arguably what Weizmann stood for is working with entities beyond the state, whether it's Great Britain or whether it's the president of the United States soon after the declaration of the state, to make sure that Israel is welcomed into the community of nations, which of course is part of the Zionist vision.
And this piece, it ends essentially, neither Weizmann nor Truman, President Harry Truman, really know what his role is will be in the state. Even when they hear he'll be president, they don't really know what that means. Certainly Truman doesn't. He thinks it means he will be talking to a head of state when he speaks to Weizmann. And as we know, the president of Israel, although an important position, is politically largely symbolic, a bully pulpit at best. The piece ends with this great moment of him walking in the front door for the first time of the White House. He's been to the White House before, but never through the front door, never as a representative of the Jewish state.
And as the final phrase is, with all protocols observed, I think that that ultimately is the great vision and the great hope of Israel and of Yom HaTzmaut, of the Day of Independence.
With that, I want to segue to a piece which might seem to be less of the day, but in a certain sense, I think is just as much about the great project of Israel and of Zionism. That is your article about the new Jewish National Library, or National Library of Israel. It's no longer the Jewish National Library.
That, right? That's correct. It's now called the National Library of Israel. That, too, is part of its history, that change of names from also being associated with the university and now occupying this position.
It starts with this great quote from Yosef, I guess his last name is Hasanovich or something like that. Basically, they were Chazans. He's a doctor, a physician, and a book collector, and he has this vision, and he writes an essay in the Zionist Hebrew daily from Warsaw, Hatzfira, in 1899. And I thought maybe you could read us that quote. We'd go from there.
I'd love to, because actually when I first started researching this piece, that quote literally jumped off the page. It's so ambitious, some might say pompous, but it's so visionary. I say that in Jerusalem there will be built a grand house, high and lofty, in which will be gathered all the fruits of Israel's spirit from the moment it became a nation. All the books written in Hebrew, and all the books in all the languages that discuss Jews and their teachings, all the writings and the paintings that touch upon their lives, everything will be collected in this great house.
Yeah. And in Hebrew, how does it read? Is it still this sort of flowery, muscular Hebrew?
It's funny, actually. I don't know that much about Hasanovich, but the Hebrew is clearly in conversation with this new revived form of Hebrew, what we now call modern Hebrew. It's not very opulent. It's relatively straightforward. So it looks a little bit different from, as you said, some of the Hebrew used by earlier modern Hebrew writers, which was very ornate, and frankly, from an aesthetic perspective, quite overdone. But even if the language isn't overly flowery, the message again is quite ambitious and remarkable.
Well, let's jump in. So how does this vision get fulfilled, and how is Chazanovich involved in that early stage?
So as we noted, he was a book collector. That was actually his great passion. There were many such book collectors actually in the late 19th century in Europe, in Eastern Europe. But he was not just collecting for himself or for even his town or the community of scholars there, but as we saw in that quote, was deliberately building a collection that he hoped would become the collection for the Jewish people. And that collection should be, must be, ultimately in the state of in what would become Israel. It gets to Jerusalem pretty early. It's a little bit of a nomadic collection. It moves around from various sites. One of them actually is the B'nai B'rith building, which still stands in Jerusalem today. But relatively soon, as Zionism as a movement becomes more firmly established with institutions and organizations, it works its way up relatively quickly into what will become the collection that the Zionists build, and that will be at the service of the Jewish people, and ultimately will be the National Library of the State of Israel.
Once it's associated with the Hebrew University, which gets founded when in 1919, 1921, something, I don't, 21, right? Where is it?
So the Hebrew University campus, the first campus, and to this day, the campus where the humanities and the social sciences and the law faculties remain, is in a place called Mount Scopus. As you can sense from the name, it's quite high up. One side of it looks over the Judean desert. Geographically, it's in a northern corner of East Jerusalem. And once the War of Independence breaks out, and then the lines are drawn, the armistice lines are drawn in a specific way. Although Mount Scopus remains in Israeli territory under Israeli control, it's essentially an enclave. And this creates a logistical nightmare of how to get the books out of Mount Scopus to a more accessible location so that patrons who are part of the Jewish state can consult the and use the books. So there's collaboration between Israeli soldiers and people who work at the library to ferry the books in military vehicles and to try to get them out of Mount Scopus and deposit in safer and more accessible locations all over town. I also note in the piece a little bit of oral history, which I heard while doing some graduate studies at Hebrew University, and I subsequently checked up on and confirmed. And that is when the library was on Mount Scopus, it was the center of as Chazanovich wanted, of Jewish studies. And there were numerous important projects, including those close to my home field of rabbinic literature, which involved compiling flashcards, index cards, with citations, with references to where, for example, different quotations of the Talmud Yerushalmi, one of the two Talmuds, appear in medieval literature. And these were cards that were painstakingly compiled over the course of years. Well, the soldiers who were stationed at Mount Scopus were bored, might have been nervous and needed to smoke, and they didn't have access to good materials. So they had a bad habit of sometimes taking these flashcards, putting tobacco inside, rolling them, and smoking them. And we even have actually, because this was an important research project, we even have, I understand it being digitized, some of these cards which didn't go up in smoke.
Well, let's jump a few decades. Did you work on your dissertation in the Jewish Studies reading room
I did.
at the National Library?
So ultimately, after Mount Scopus was inaccessible, a new building was erected, in which on Hebrew University's campus in Western Jerusalem, in Givat Ram, and it was simply a remarkable place, a place that I already realized then was like no other that I knew in the world to work on serious Jewish studies research. Of course, the collections were amazing, and you could just get out of your seat, and there was a very carefully curated open stacks that had everything that you needed depending on your field, and then the ability to call up books from across the discipline. But the other amazing thing about that library, were the human resources. And that's not only the librarians who made sure to keep a clean and quiet reading room, but also and especially the various experts in different fields. You might come across, let's say, a text in a language that you did not have great facility, and you would know, oh, so and so, three tables down, has facility in that language, in that literature. And you could really bounce around quite productively between not just books, but people as you made your way in your research project. At the same time, that bouncing around wasn't always productive, or at least wasn't always productive in the conventional senses. There was a lot of hawking, idle hawking, by which I mean bouncing ideas off of each other, talking about this, that, and the other thing, sharing novelties, but deliberately without clear purpose, really just to have fun. And that too was very much part of the culture already then in the National Library.
Now you've learned in an earlier stage of your life, you learned in classical yeshivot. Was it a little bit like a yeshiva? How is it different from a yeshiva?
So there's often this distinction that's made between what learning looks like, let's say, in an academic, even Jewish studies library, like the National Library of Israel, and a study hall and a base medrash, such as the one I studied in Neir Yisrael in Baltimore. Of course, it's much louder, cacophonous. One learns, in groups of two, sometimes three, in a base medrash, in a study hall. While in the library, as I noted, the librarians ran a tight ship and would shush you if you made too much noise. So certainly that distinction is true. But and again, at least in my experience, having worked in libraries all over the world, the National Library of Israel kind of did combine both, maybe not in exactly the same space, but that same energy where you could walk out of the reading room and converse with people and learn together again, hawk, to me, to my mind, is sort of the perfect marriage of these two models of silent, you know, monastic study and locutious Jewish learning together under one roof.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. I'll just add one thing, which is, if you're in the Beis Medrash and you're learning, the feel is different if the Rosh Yeshiva happens to be there or some of the Rosh Yeshiva, and one thing about the Jewish Studies reading room that also made it unique, and to a certain extent, at least for me, when I was there trying to write a dissertation, terrifying, was that they were these grand figures of the field who were just sitting next to you, although they had their established places. So I remember, this would be 97, 98 for me, and I was writing something in modern Jewish history, and a few tables over was Yaakov Katz, the greatest figure in the field of modern Jewish history, arguably. And there he was, I don't know how old he was, but he looked like he was 120, and he looked like he weighed about 120 pounds. And he'd be carrying this huge stack of books over to his place. And it was, it was awe-inspiring also to see what a life of scholarship meant, that this man who had, by that time for 40 or 50 years been writing epic setting, works, was still grinding, steiging away. Well, let's jump to the new building. You say it's the most beautiful building in Jerusalem. Tell us about it.
It feels actually, in some ways, like a great European library. I actually have a funny story to share about that, which I didn't mention in the piece, but an old student of mine saw me on one of the first days that I went to the library when the new library was built, and told me that he no longer felt comfortable going in his shorts and t-shirt, which is usually how he and many others would go to the library in Jerusalem. But he felt like he had to get dressed up a little more like a European library. But the other thing about this building, which I think brings to fruition Hasanovich's vision, is the insistence that every book in the collection will be held in the building. And you can even see this if you descend the staircase from the entrance floor to, as it were, minus one. There is something like a porthole that looks out at endless, seemingly endless, and very tall shelves that contain the entirety of the collection that's not on the open stacks. And there are robots that are there which retrieve the books, which you order using a very sophisticated online system.
So this is an extraordinary national project, and now situated at the center of the nation's capital. But we're discussing it not only on Yom HaZikaron, which is the day we happen to be taping this, but also, of course, in the midst of the Gaza War. And in fact, when you visited the museum at its opening, it was after October 7th. So how does one think about this grand successful project at this moment?
That's a great question. When I visited, it was at the end of October. The the library actually was supposed to have been open to great fanfare immediately following Sukkot. Of course, October 7th fell at the end of Sukkot. And not only was the grand opening postponed, but there was even concern about some of the artifacts, which had to be secured for some time. Ultimately, the decision was taken to open the library to the public, but it was done without the fanfare, and it was also done with sensitivity to the situation. So the librarians put together a moving exhibition with chairs that were arranged initially in a circle in the middle of the library, each chair being dedicated to a different hostage, and each hostage chair with a book that through research the librarians learned was meaningful to that particular hostage, so that when you walked into the library you could see particular books that were and are beloved by the hostages, some of whom, thank God, have been since released. The most difficult, of course, was to see children's books for the children, hostages. And in this way, both acknowledge the moment and also acknowledge the place of the library in this moment. Yes, it was difficult, sometimes even surreal, to be in the library when the country was at war. But it also somehow underlined the stakes and the significance of a library like this. I quote in the piece a joke. I think it's a bad joke, but it's also a telling joke that's attributed to an Oxford Don in the First World War, when someone challenges him about why he's staying in his study and not out at the front protecting civilization, to which he infamously retorts, "I am civilization." Now, I don't think humans should speak that way, but I do think the case can be made that in a way, part of what's being fought for is a Jewish state with a great heritage that is housed in the special institution. So in that way, the significance and importance of the library during wartime is clear, is poignant, and is something I think that we can all be extremely proud of as we go into celebration of Yom HaTzmaut, of the Israeli Day of Independence.
I mean, the only thing I would add, which you took for granted, is that the library takes in wanting to gather in everything a capacious and liberal conception of that civilization.
That's right.
And that heritage. And that's something to celebrate.
Definitely.
Maybe on that note, could you read us those the words with which you end the piece, from Hasanovich, the original library dreamer?
Yes, of course. And this too is points from the books that he believed needed to be gathered in Jerusalem to the people who read them. This is what he says. "To this great house shall stream our masters, sages, and all the scholars of our nation, and everyone with a heart which understands our literature, and whose spirit yearns and strives for the Torah and for wisdom, and to know of the history of our people and the lives of our ancestors."
Thanks again to my colleague Shai Secunda for coming on. The JRB podcast is a production of the Jewish Review of Books and was produced by Akiva Schick. You can read Shai's essay, This Great House, and Reinhardt's and Golani's You May View the Land from a Distance, and the rest of the issue at jewishreviewofbooks.com. And please subscribe to our podcast via Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Google Podcasts. Oh, and leave us a 5-star review. The algorithm likes that, and we'd appreciate it. Meanwhile, keep reading.